The Sea Grant Files, fresh news about fresh water.
Hi, I'm Jesse Schomburg, and you're listening to the Sea Grant Files. Dr. John Pastor, a professor of biology at the University of Minnesota Duluth, is here with me in the studio to talk about a 5-year research project and what it taught him and his colleagues about wild rice's response to elevated sulfate levels. Thanks for being a part of the Sea Grant Files, John.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
So, John, my burning question for you is this. You've built a career on studying the structure and function of northern ecosystems, the application of mathematics to ecological problems and scientific illustration, and you recently wrote a book called What Does a Clever Moose Eat? How does studying wild rice productivity in Minnesota's lakes and wetlands fit into your career? What led you and your colleagues to ask questions about how sulfate affects wild rice?
Good question. Well, first, wild rice is characteristic of northern systems. It really doesn't grow out of the North Woods all that much. One of the characteristics of northern populations is that they fluctuate a lot, big boom and bust cycles. And wild rice undergoes these kinds of boom and bust cycles. And we started just asking questions about that and doing experiments about that. So just basic research about wild rice population ecology in relationship to nutrient cycling. And this was with funding from the National Science Foundation in collaboration with the tribes here, particularly Grand Portage and Fond du Lac reservations. And then this whole issue of sulfate came up, and the tribes asked me if I wanted to take a look at that. Sulfate runoff from the mines and getting into the waters and what effect it might have on wild rice. And my first response was, no, sulfate's complicated. You need a real sulfate guy to deal with this. And they said, no, we want you. So we started doing some pilot experiments, just growing wild rice in pots and adding different amounts of sulfate just to see what the reaction was. And we did get a decrease in growth, but particularly a decrease in seed production 2 years in a row. And that was unusual because when you look at the growth of the plant, the leaves and stems, there wasn't really that much difference. There was a little decrease. But there was a 20% decrease in seed production. I started thinking, well, what's going on here? Why is the seed production so much more than the leaf production? And then the state gave Minnesota Pollution Control Agency a boatload of money to study the problem with respect to the standard. Minnesota is one of the few states that has a sulfate standard on wild rice. In fact, I think the only state. And it's quite low. It's 10 milligrams per liter, which is very low. And because of the ramp up of mining, the copper nickel mines and everything else, the state wanted the PCA to study this. And so the PCA came to us, asked us to put in a proposal. We did. We were accepted to help them in their work. I want to make the point here that people spend a lot of time making a distinction between basic and applied research. The basic research we're doing for 8 years on wild rice population cycles led us to this particular application. Without that basic research on how to grow wild rice, how to analyze its life cycle, we couldn't have jumped in to answer this applied question. So I don't like this distinction between basic and applied research. This is, I think, a really good example where the basic research allows us to very quickly answer some sort of an applied question.
So Minnesota Sea Grant funded some of the wild rice research. So did, as you said, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, along with Minnesota's Clean Water Fund, the Fond du Lac and Grand Portage bands of Lake Superior Chippewa. And these were partly through grants from the U.S. EPA, as I understand.
Right, but also some bona fide tribal funds from the tribal councils, and I thank them for that.
Yeah, excellent. So after all of this work, what have you come away with? What are some of the big takeaways from sulfate and wild rice work?
Well, it's not sulfate itself has no deleterious effect on wild rice. What happens when the sulfate, which is soluble in water, and that's how it leaches from the mines and gets into the wild rice beds, when it gets into the sediments, there's a group of bacteria that convert that to sulfide. Sulfate is sulfur with four oxygens around it, and there's no oxygen in the sediments. And this is a crude way of putting it. These bacteria kind of use the oxygens bound to the sulfate as their oxygen source. A lot of chemists are cringing right now to hear me say that.
But we'll apologize to them.
And we've shown this is sulfide that's toxic to wild rice. One set of our tanks, we maintain sulfate at or slightly above the EPA drinking water standard for sulfate, and that produced so much sulfide that in 5 years, those wild rice populations have gone extinct. So wild rice is more sensitive to sulfate than human beings are, about 100 times more sensitive to sulfate and sulfide than human beings are.
So we're here in the studio talking with UMD professor John Pastor about the results of a wild rice study that he and several colleagues published in the journal Ecological Applications. So, John, I've heard you say that the sulfate-wild rice interaction is the most complicated problem you've tackled. What made it so challenging?
Well, first place, there's the transformations from sulfate to sulfide. The amount of carbon in the, sugars and stuff like that in the sediments that provides the energy to the microbes is also involved. And then the interaction with iron, and then the cessation of the uptake of nitrogen and phosphorus. So we've got the cycles of four or five elements that are kind of coming together in wild rice. This is the most complicated problem in my entire career.
So how might this research be used?
Well, the PCA is using the results of our research for evaluating the current standard and deciding whether they're going to modify that in any way. In fact, three PCA scientists are co-authors on our paper. They have all our data. In fact, all our data is published online as part of this paper, so we've made this data freely available to anyone. So I think it'll be used most directly in evaluating the current state standard and whether to keep it or change it. But the rest of the scientific community, I think, particularly people interested in sulfur pollution, are also going to look at this work.
Some pretty important stuff that our state's faced with dealing with this.
It is. Wild rice is the state grain. It's an important staple and sacred food for the Ojibwe. This is a big thing.
So, John, how do you eat wild rice?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a favorite way to prepare it?
Oh, we do it, the standard way of boiling it until it's done and then eating it, but adding cranberries to it. I have a recipe for wild rice sour cream scones that are really good. And we have a couple of wild rice cookbooks. There's lots of ways. Wild rice pancakes are also good.
Oh, that I want to try. So before you go, John, your book published by Island Press, What Does a Clever Moose Eat? So what's it about? Who's the intended audience? And what does a clever moose eat?
Well, what does a clever moose eat? That's something for another show. But what it's about is it's a collection of essays about the natural history of the North Woods and what natural history is all about and why it's still important, even in this age of computer modeling and genomic analysis and everything else. All biological questions start with an observation in natural history. And so in the book, I just talk about a variety of observations that anybody can make in walking in the woods and where that might lead in understanding the ecology of the past and the future of the North Woods. I know a lot of people who aren't scientists who have read the book and have liked it and have learned a lot. Northland College is using it as a textbook. Memorial University in Newfoundland is using it as a textbook. In fact, I'm flying out there in a few weeks they invited me out to give some talks and a reading of the book. So it could be used as a textbook in class or for a discussion class. You could just read it, book clubs, whatever.
Sounds excellent. So thanks for being a part of the Sea Grant Files, John. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Jesse. It's been fun.
This episode of the Sea Grant Files was produced by Sharon Moen, Mariah Schumacher, Maya Jensen, KUMD, and me, Jesse Schomburg. To listen to more episodes of the Sea Grant Files and to subscribe to our podcast, visit the Minnesota Sea Grant website at www.seagrant.umn.edu. You can also follow Minnesota Sea Grant on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks for listening.